From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with essayist Nancy Mears about becoming the woman she couldn't bear to be, only to find herself able to bear it. Mears has for years been chronicling the effect of multiple sclerosis on her life, in spite of the fact it's a subject she'd rather not obsess on. As you'll hear, she's hardly a member of what she describes as the inspirational class of writers. Her new memoir is called Waist High in the World. It's a follow-up to an earlier memoir about her life as a Catholic and feminist. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Contesting Tears, the Hollywood melodrama of the unknown woman, a new book about the weepy women's movies of the 30s and 40s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The House of Representatives has only one item on its agenda today, a reprimand for Speaker Newt Gingrich and a $300,000 penalty. House leaders expect the sanctions to be approved. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Yesterday was a day of bipartisan warmth and celebration. Today, Republican leaders are hoping to quickly dispose of the Speaker's ethical troubles and move on to pursuing their legislative agenda. Both Democrats and Republicans predict that the Ethics Committee's recommendations will pass. Republican Conference Chairman John Boehner says the Speaker's critics appear to be, quote, calling off the dogs.
I think that the Democrats realize that this political holy war needs to come to an end. The Speaker's admitted his mistakes. He's agreed with the charges, and so I think that it'll be wrapped up rather quickly.
House leaders are making sure it will be wrapped up quickly. They're allowing only 1 hour of debate and no amendments. That leaves the question of the fine. Boehner is among those who say the Speaker should not use campaign funds to pay it. I'm Peter Kenyon at the Capitol.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin is doing paperwork at his country home outside Moscow today as he continues to recover from double pneumonia. Meanwhile, an effort to oust him from power is moving forward in the Russian parliament. A draft resolution will be presented to lawmakers tomorrow that calls for the removal of the president on health grounds. But legal advisers say the Russian parliament has no legal right to force Yeltsin from power, and even the resolution's author doesn't give it much chance of success. Still, the question of whether the Russian leader is fit to govern overshadows all debates. Two powerful earthquakes have killed at least 12 people in China's far western province. More than 1,000 families fled damaged homes in the bitter cold. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports.
The first earthquake came mid-morning and registered 6.4 on the Richter scale. The second followed a minute later with a magnitude of 6.3. The epicenter of the quake was Jiaxu County in China's northwestern province of Xinjiang, a sparsely populated, mostly Muslim region. The area had been already suffering from its most bitterly cold winter in 30 years. When the earthquakes came, more than 1,000 families had to abandon their homes, lest they collapse, and take their chances in the snow. About 500 one-story buildings did collapse, and others suffered structural damage. In recent days, more than 30 people in Xinjiang have died as a result of the cold, so for those left homeless by the quake, the danger is by no means past. I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Shanghai.
Los Angeles police have spent several hours questioning two possible witnesses in the murder of Enes Cosby, son of entertainer Bill Cosby. LA police say they'll release a statement about the questioning later today. That may reveal what, if anything, detectives might have learned from the unidentified pair. Police say both are not considered suspects. On Wall Street, the Dow was up more than 20 points at 68.64. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan says an era of low inflation may be coming to an end. Greenspan told the Senate Banking Committee today the economy did better than he expected last year, but he says low unemployment could force business to pay higher wages for salaries. That in turn could drive up prices. A new survey by health benefits consulting firm Foster Higgins finds healthcare inflation slowed down last year, but there are signs that health prices are headed back up. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
Every year, Foster Higgins asks employers what they and their workers and retirees are paying for health care. Last year, the cost totaled nearly $4,000 per worker. That was an increase of 2.5% over the previous year, slower than general inflation. But health care inflation could be accelerating again. Employers in the survey expect their health plan costs will go up 4% in 1997. Foster Higgins analyst John Erb says businesses have already gotten most employees into managed care, so there are no more savings to be had by moving workers out of the more open, expensive type of health insurance. And HMO rates have begun rising. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
Chrysler says it earned $807 million in the fourth quarter last year. The results are 22% lower from a year ago, but they're still the company's second-best full-year earnings report in history. For all of 1996, Chrysler earned $3.5 billion. The automaker says it will distribute profit-sharing checks to its U.S. workers. The average check will be worth $7,900. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the New Prospect Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment and the Indiana-based Lilly Endowment Incorporated for coverage of religion.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Nancy Mears has written a memoir about a subject she doesn't want to dwell on, her crippled life. Those are her words, not mine. Mears has multiple sclerosis and can no longer walk or use one of her arms. She wrote her book in the hopes of discovering what physical, emotional, moral, and spiritual elements shape the, quote, differences created by disability. Mears' previous books include Ordinary Time, a spiritual autobiography about being a Catholic and feminist and reconciling the two, and Voice Lessons, chronicling her life as a writer. Here she is reading from her new memoir, Waist High in the World.
I am literally diminished by my disability, reduced to a height of about 4 feet 8 inches, consigned to gazing at navels, generally shrouded, other than my own. But diminution is not the whole of it. Waist high also resonates with knee deep. This is no piteously deprived state I'm in down here, but a rich, complicated, an entirely absorbing process of immersion in whatever the world has to offer. This is not, however, a feel-good book. Too bad, because if it were, it might spend weeks on the New York Times bestseller list and make of me the wealthy woman I have always dreamed of being. In truth, I would give my eye teeth, which narrowly escaped being knocked out, along with my incisors, when I fell flat on my face several years back, to write a bestseller. But this is not it. I am not now, nor have I ever been, a member of the inspirational class. I suppose you might call this, instead, a feel-real book, and reality has never been high on any popular list. I ask you to read this book, then, not to be uplifted, but to be lowered and steadied into what may be unfamiliar, but is not inhospitable space. Sink down beside me, take my hand, and together we'll watch the wastes of the world drift past.
Nancy Mears, why did you want to write this book?
Well, that presupposes that I did want to write this book. And for many years, I didn't want to write this book. It turned out to be the hardest one I've done so far, though each time I was doing one, I thought it was the hardest. I've written about disability in my other books, but never sustained a focus on it. And the danger in this project to me was having to spend day after day after day scrutinizing the aspects of my life that are the most difficult.
The aspects that you try hardest to transcend or not think about.
Or just deny. Mm-hmm. I know that denial sounds far-fetched in my case. I mean, here I am, crumpled up in a wheelchair. It must be pretty hard to deny such a state, but I do my best, you know. We're all deniers at heart. So, you know, I would try to think about, I've always tried to think about other things. And suddenly I was not going to be able to do that any longer. But I thought it was an important project, not perhaps so much for me anymore, but for readers who perhaps haven't my length of experience with disability, either newly disabled themselves or finding themselves taking care of someone with a disability, or simply aging and growing closer to disability that way. I just thought I could be encouraging. Oh, God, I sound like Pollyanna, don't I?
Well, you know, as you say in the book, I am not and have never been a member of the inspirational class. What do you consider to be the inspirational class, and why don't you want to be a member of that?
Oh, there are an awful lot of books. Writing about personal difficulties has become pretty popular in recent years, you know. It's something that I call the literature of personal disaster, only half facetiously. There's some really wonderful work in that genre. I think immediately, for instance, of Andre Debussy's Broken Vessels, or Reynolds Price's A Whole New Life. But a lot of it is badly written. It's simplistically conceived and then badly written, and then marketed to somehow raise you up. And I never feel raised up by that sort of thing. I feel sort of embarrassed by it. Maybe it's my Yankee roots or something, but I just feel embarrassed by it. And anyway, it doesn't reflect the truth of experience.
You have people who call you, people who don't know you.
Oh, yes.
But, you know, have read your work and know you have MS. And I'm talking about people who either have MS or think that they're developing MS, and they want your advice. They want to commiserate with you. What kind of position does that put you in? What do you feel equipped to tell them, not being a member of the inspirational
team? Usually, it's somebody who's, you know, read at least one of my books. And so all I really have to do is say, still here. You know, I'm still here. And I don't have to be inspirational. It's just so reassuring to know that, well, I have said, in I think more than one place in my writing, I am now the woman I never thought I could bear to be. And still at it. And it still somehow is a, as I said in that little passage I read, a rich, complicated experience. I'm not diminished by my disability except in a literal sense, except in the sense that I really am only 4'8" in my wheelchair. But I'm augmented by it. It's something added into my life experience. And so I can just talk to people very frankly. The ones who have disabilities who call generally aren't asking to be inspired, but they are asking to be reassured.
When you say that you've become the woman you didn't think you could bear to be, do you mean you thought it would just be too horrible, too depressing to live with MS?
Yes, I did. When I was first diagnosed, I wasn't terribly disabled. I limped. I had to use a cane quite soon and then a brace. But I managed to lead what one would call a normal life. I was a graduate student, a teacher. I had two small children, and I was their mother, and I had a husband. And, you know, it was harder sometimes for me to do these things than other people, but I could still do them. And so I can remember a couple of times going to an event where there were other people with MS. I didn't do it very often in those days, but I would, and I would see somebody in a wheelchair and think, you know, if it gets to that point, I'm checking out. Well, the the checkout point changes over time, I think we discover. And at the moment, I'm not inclined to check out. Despite what Jack Kevorkian may say about the appalling lack of quality in my life.
Well, how much movement do you have now?
I can pull myself to my feet. I can't walk at all, but I can, you know, pull myself. I can, for instance, still transfer to the toilet, which becomes a much cherished ability, I will tell you. I can't move my left side at all. I have some use of my right hand. I still can use my computer mouse, and I can even keyboard sloppily. But I also have voice-activated software.
My guest is Nancy Mayers. Her new memoir is called Waist High in the World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Nancy Mayers. Her new memoir is called Waist High in the World, A Life Among the Non-Disabled. It's about living with multiple sclerosis. MS is a progressive illness, and as you say, no matter how bad you feel today, your symptoms might be worse tomorrow.
Yes.
How do you deal psychologically knowing that MS gets worse and that your symptoms are likely to get worse?
I'm not sure that I'm very good at dealing with that knowledge. One of the ways I deal with it is not to think about it, that kind of denial. Another way is to reassure myself that if it gets too bad, I can always commit suicide.
Well, that's actually a really fuzzy area for you because, as you say in your book, you've had a problem with clinical depression throughout your life. I mean, long before you got MS, you got problems with depression. And, I mean, there's a certain degree of depression in which some people become suicidal even if they're, you know, physically healthy and their body is strong. So how do you trust yourself to make the right decision there, that you won't give in to just what might be a passing depression?
No, I don't trust myself at all. And in fact, I would go so far as to say to you that if I do kill myself, then I will have made the wrong decision. It'll be made and it'll be irrevocable, but it won't have been the right decision. There is a phrase people use about killing oneself under these circumstances, rational suicide. But I'm not sure that any suicide can be done rationally. So I have the feeling that even if I do it, and that's what happens, it won't have been the right decision. I don't trust myself. But I do, over the years, one develops a little sort of self-cynicism, perhaps. And I think in Waist High, I think I describe an incident where I decide I've got to kill myself because I think my husband's cancer has returned. Only at least I have the sense to await the test results. And it turns out that he hasn't got cancer, and it would have been pretty dumb to kill myself. But, you know, I'm old enough now. I'm 53 now and have enough experience with depression and attempted suicide that I managed to defer the decision just long enough to discover that he had something called pseudomembranous colitis instead, which sounds deadly but isn't.
You have tried to take your life in the past.
Yes, more than once.
Well, can I ask how recent the last time was?
I celebrated my 16th anniversary in October. I haven't tried to kill myself since 1980. And I won't be cocky, but at the moment, I don't seem inclined to.
I guess you remember the date well enough that it's become an anniversary.
Oh, yes, October 31st, 1980.
What happened that day?
Well, I had been given a prescription for an antidepressant called amitriptyline, and I took the month's worth all at once instead of at the correct dosage. And nobody's quite sure why I didn't die, but I didn't. I was unconscious for 18 hours, and then I woke up and I wasn't depressed anymore. And I've always thought that what I did with this huge overdose was kick myself straight out of the depression.
I guess you could say the drugs worked.
The drugs worked, right. The horrible thing is, of course, that, well, one of the horrible things is that I could have become a vegetable. Lived, but you know, ruined my brain completely.
Did you already have MS when you tried to take your life in 1980?
When I did in 1980, yes. I was diagnosed in 72, but not the first couple of times I had tried to kill myself. I was, 17 the first time and 24, I guess, the second time.
Was there something that happened around the time of that suicide attempt?
No. That's the curious thing about clinical depression, you know, is it's very different from situational depression in that nothing has to happen to bring it on. I think, in truth, I had been living in a state of at least mild clinical depression for years and years and years, and nobody had picked it up and medicated me. Now, in the 16 years since the last suicide attempt, I have been medicated every day, and I think that makes an enormous difference, because when you're talking clinical depression, you're talking biochemical problems rather than life problems, you know. One can't handle the life problems very well if one is depressed.
So when you say medicated, you mean antidepressants?
Yes. Yes, I take an antidepressant every day.
Do you find, I don't know if you can, I know the antidepressants are a factor here, so I don't know how you'd weigh them in, but do you think that the MS has affected your depression?
Well, this is going to sound ironic, but yes, probably, if anything, it's helped my depression.
Let me guess here. My guess would be that the reason why is that you have something to you have a very real problem to focus on.
Yes,
that's very time consuming.
I think that's it. There's an enormous challenge to living with a disability. I don't like the euphemisms. So, for instance, I don't care to be called physically challenged, though I am physically challenged. The trouble with the term is, what's the difference between me and somebody climbing Mount Everest, you know? They're physically challenged also, so it's not a meaningful phrase. But the fact is that to live well with a disability is a great challenge. And it's human nature to try to rise to an occasion, to do something well if one has to do it. And I think that that probably has helped me to avoid sliding back into situations that encourage my depression. My husband almost died 6 years ago of melanoma. And we don't know why he didn't, in fact, but he didn't. But you know, we have never been happier. We live with cancer and we live with multiple sclerosis. But we've never been happier. And it's not because we're little saints or little Pollyannas either. It's because we know how brief life is, how little time we have, and we're damned if we're going to pollute it. So we don't put up with nonsense.
You know, since you both, in a way, have broken bodies, his body has been changed by cancer, yours by MS, do you feel that there's a certain equality in the relationship that wouldn't be in the relationship if, say, you had MS and he was, like, really healthy, high spirits, you know, that maybe in a situation like that, there's the sense of the caregiver and the care getter and...
And our identities are mixed up in this case. That's
yeah,
true.
Right.
That's true. I certainly do think about it. I certainly find myself wondering. He had an affair a number of years ago. And I find myself wondering, if the cancer hadn't come back, would he have just kept going, you know?
With the affair?
With the affair and on out of my life and into... hers or some others, was it the cancer that pulled him back to me? I ask myself that sometimes. And in truth, I don't think there's a clear answer to it. Yes, probably. But on the other hand, that's probably not the whole reason. But I do, you know, on those nights when one just doesn't drift off nicely into sleep and then all the bugbears start looming up around the edge of the bed. You know, then I do things like that and I say, oh, you know, oh my God, if he were a healthy human being, he could never stay with me. Who would want to stay with me? But then the next morning, he gets me up and he puts my clothes on me because I can't dress myself anymore. And he oogles me. Well, ogles me. Oogle is our private term. As though I were a sexy, desirable human being. Apparently, he thinks I am a sexy, desirable human being. So what am I to make of that? Maybe he stayed because he has the hots for me, you know?
Nancy Mayers. Her new memoir is called Waist High in the World. She'll be back with us in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, learning to let others help. We continue our conversation with Nancy Mayers about how multiple sclerosis has changed her life. And Maureen Carrigan reviews a new book about Hollywood melodramas of the 30s and 40s. Coming up, learning to let others help. We continue our conversation with Nancy Mayers about how multiple sclerosis has changed her life. And Maureen Carrigan reviews a new book about Hollywood melodramas of the 30s and 40s. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with writer Nancy Mayers. Her new memoir, Waist High in the World, chronicles living with multiple sclerosis. This progressive illness was diagnosed over 20 years ago. Now, Mayers can no longer walk, and she can use only one arm, and that arm has little strength.
Now, have you changed your attitude toward being cared for? As you said, your husband cares for you, he dresses you, he takes care of a lot of your... He bathes you, I imagine?
Yes, he helps me get into and out of the shower and puts the lotion on afterwards and all that.
It can be really hard to be cared for on a regular basis.
I hate it. I'm working on it. I certainly... If I weren't going to just drive myself over the brink, I had to accept it. And so I work very hard at accepting it. And most of the time I do pretty well, but then something will happen like, I guess it was about a month ago, I fell off the toilet. And it was an enormously humiliating experience. I was locked in my studio, which is separate from the house. Fortunately, it was the housekeeper's day. But she was in the house listening to Spanish music at top volume. I knew because I'd just been in there. So I'm lying on the bathroom floor of my studio saying, help, help. Finally, I got tired of that, so I started saying, I've fallen and I can't get up. And eventually, Carmen came out to sweep the porch and the walk, and she heard me, and she knew where the spare key was, and she opened the door, let herself into the studio, and cleaned me up and pulled my clothes back on, and I went on with my life, because humiliation turns out not to be a terminal disease, but it's damned unpleasant. And, you know, I just hated that. I hated every minute of it. It was humiliating and also frightening.
Would you have preferred that your husband rescued you from that episode, or was it better to have someone who you have a professional relationship with?
No, I really would have preferred George. George and I are extremely intimate. Well, partners tend to be, but I mean even beyond that, because the nature of his cancer entailed bowel surgery and a lot of kind of messy things, chemotherapy with lots of throwing up and what have you. So I feel very close to his body, and I think he feels very close to my body. And it was very, very difficult for me to permit an outsider to see me in that condition. Carmen is hardly an outsider. She's been my housekeeper for 9 years now. But even so, we haven't had, you know, a relationship that involved picking me up off the bathroom floor before, and I just was devastated by that. And one has to accept those feelings of humiliation and devastation. One has to feel them and accept them, as unpleasant as they are, in order to be able to let them go and go on with one's life.
Let me ask something gloomy. A little earlier, you said that when you thought your husband might be having a recurrence of his cancer, you seriously considered taking your life, and you didn't, and it turned out that it was a false alarm. But excuse me for bringing this up, but say he did pass before you. How would you, I mean, do you think about that kind of thing now, how you would cope?
I think about that thing all the time. With a good bit of fear and a great deal of sadness. My guess is that even though I told you that I believe that suicide is the wrong choice, that I might well make that choice. What would discourage me, I think, is concern for my children, who are now not little children at all. They're 27 and 31, and I have just learned that I'm going to have a grandbaby next summer.
Oh, congratulations.
And isn't that wonderful? They've been trying for a long time, and it's really going to happen, we think. So anyway, if I were to kill myself, then I would leave these children with a mother who committed suicide. And I'm not sure that I could do that to them, you know? Mm-hmm. I almost did a couple of times, and I'm appalled now, in retrospect, at what those suicide attempts conveyed to my children, that they had a mother who was willing to leave them. And I don't want them to have to live with that, to believe themselves that cheaply valued, that I would be willing to leave them. And people, you know, have asked me, well, you know, couldn't I live with the children or have them take care of me? And I've said stiffly, that's not who I want to be in their lives.
Right.
And it isn't at all. But the fact is that I can't know what's going to happen if George does die before me. Who knows what will happen?
Mm-hmm.
I pray, of course, that I'm going to die before him. I go to bed at night ready, not suicidal at all, but simply I've had a good day, and basically I say, okay, God, I don't believe God does these things, but, you know, it's sort of a convenient way of framing things, it's an habitual way of framing. Okay, God, tonight could be the night. I'm ready.
Do you feel that medically you're close to death, or are you just metaphorically?
I'm not, I think. I think I'm, aside from the fact that I'm a smoker, I'm probably in quite good health.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, people with disabilities aren't sick necessarily. We get sick. My husband's got a cold, and I suppose I'm going to get it too, just like anybody.
Yeah.
But as a rule, I'm pretty healthy. So no, there isn't any immediate reason that I ought to die. But I wouldn't mind if it were offered to me. You know, I try to live my life each day in such a way that it can be the last day and I will be satisfied with it.
So you're a smoker, huh? Do you think...
Alas, I am.
Do you feel that having MS almost gives you an excuse to smoke because, A, there's a lot of pleasures you're deprived of, and, B, it's not like you're going to run the mile anyways?
Well, both of those things, particularly the former, I think. I have this feeling that I have had to give up so damn much. I just don't feel like giving up one more thing. And anyway, guess what am I staying alive for? So, but it's a perfectly self-indulgent behavior, and that's a perfectly stupid line of reasoning. I'm aware of that.
What does your doctor tell you about that line of reasoning?
Oh, they roll their eyes. And actually, I did have one doctor tell me, kind of privately, if you could get it down to 5 cigarettes a day, I would just say, go ahead. It can't hurt at that level. But alas, I don't have it down to 5 cigarettes a day. It's more like 15 cigarettes a day. And so even that doctor wouldn't be pleased with me. So nobody's pleased with me.
My guest is Nancy Mears, and her new memoir is called Waist High in the World, A Life Among the Non-Disabled. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Nancy Mears, and her new memoir is about living with MS. It's called Waist High in the World. Nancy, you say you're a person who really likes solitude, but on the other hand, there's an etiquette to taking care from others which demands a considerable degree of the very sociability that you think you lack.
Mm-hmm.
I thought
yes.
That was really interesting. I think I understand what you mean there, but I'm going to ask you to elaborate on it.
Well, I love being alone.
Mm-hmm.
And aloneness requires considerable physical capacity, something I'm sure you've never thought about. But to manage without anybody else around means that you've got to be able, for instance, to open and close doors, to answer the telephone, you know, very basic things. And I'm looking at a time when I won't be able to manage even those things. And I certainly can't manage very much as it is. I can remain alone all day because before he leaves for school in the morning, George makes me some lunch and puts it in the refrigerator. I can't make my own lunch. I wouldn't starve. You know, you can always call Pizza Hut or something, but the truth is that I can't really provide for myself without a lot of assistance. And at the moment, we can arrange things in such a way that I am alone for several hours every day without feeling too endangered. I have recently gotten a cellular telephone, which makes me feel just ludicrously yuppie, but which makes a considerable sense if I want to do things like falling off the toilet. It makes sense to be able to call somebody to one's rescue.
Did you keep that in the wheelchair?
So, in fact, generally I wear it on a cord around my neck. At the moment, it's in the side pocket of the wheelchair, but yes, I'm never without my cellular telephone now. But I still have got to have help with all those personal things like showering and dressing and what have you. And particularly if anything happened to George, and this doesn't mean necessarily his death, but simply if he were to get, suppose he broke his wrist, for instance, something very simple and basically healthy like that, we'd be in a terrible pickle. We'd have to hire somebody to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And I dread that. I just dread that. If I were by nature gregarious, I suppose I could look forward to somebody's arrival as a bright spot in the day or what have you. But the bright spot in my day is people's leaving. Ooh, it makes me sound like a terrible prune, doesn't it? Sour old puss. But it isn't that at all when I'm with people, on my own terms, I'm happy to be with people. I'm having a lovely time talking to you, and I wish we were in the same room. But, as I say, for several hours a day, I need that solitude. It's like replenishment of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
It's very tiring now for me to be sociable also. It is just physically tiring to talk. Particularly in a crowded situation.
Do you often think about your life and your identity before you got MS?
I think about my life before I got MS a lot, although not necessarily as something without MS, just I think all of us think about our pasts a lot. As far as identity goes, I look back and think I was a very wretched creature as a girl and young woman. I think my depression had probably started by the time I was 12 or 13, and of course it was undiagnosed for years, and then not awfully well treated. And I was totally without a sense of humor. Just the somberest, saddest creature you could imagine. And I like myself ever so much better now. And I think part of the reason I like myself is that I have MS, you know? It's loosened me up. It's opened me up. And it's also made me funnier.
Well, do you think it's made you more forgiving of yourself?
Yes, perhaps that's it, that I am more forgiving of myself. I was an incredible perfectionist. My teachers made me skip the third grade because I used to get so distraught over anything less than an A that they thought it would be good for me to be put in a situation where I would have to get something less than an A. Only that didn't turn out to work at all. I simply went into the fourth grade and insisted on getting A's there, even though I hadn't gone to the third grade. The most dreadful consequence of which is that I never learned my multiplication tables. And to this day, I don't want you to ask me what 9 times 4 is. So that perfectionism continued. I started developing migraines, which is a pretty common accompaniment to that attitude. And it went on, and then suddenly I entered a life where I couldn't possibly be perfect. I am unquestionably damaged. I still get very angry with myself for my shortcomings and failures, for being crippled. I get furious with myself for being crippled. But I can recognize that when it's going on and let it go and say, not only am I all right this way, but I think I'm all righter this way than I was the other way.
The Supreme Court is currently considering the legality of assisted suicide. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Like a lot of people with disabilities, I'm troubled by it. By the question of whether this sort of thing should be legal. I have great sympathy for people who want to end their lives, but I also know I've lived very closely with cancer. I've lost a lot of friends to cancer. So even in the case of terminal illness, there are options that well people don't necessarily see. And particularly now with people with disabilities, able-bodied people may look at us and say, our lives are unbearable, our lives are intolerable, we should be helped to end them. That's what Jack Kevorkian did with all those people, many of whom had MS, by the way, on the basis of a single meeting saying, well, of course your life is just dreadful, and let's get it over with. If that becomes an attitude in a society like ours, particularly where our values are so economically based, we begin to think about someone's life in terms of how many resources they're sucking up. It becomes very easy to hold that life cheaper than some other life, some able-bodied person's life, let's say. And that attitude can really permeate the whole society to the point where those who are able think that us disabled ought to get out of the way and stop sucking up the resources. Mm-hmm. And those of us who are disabled feel so horrendously guilty about existing that we're driven to suicide. So I think that throwing this into the legal arena is probably not a good idea. It should remain, as it has for many, many centuries, a very private matter between a person and her caregiver, her health provider, her spiritual counselor, but not decided in the public domain.
Nancy Mears, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I had a great time.
Nancy Mears' new memoir is called Waist High in the World. Coming up, a new book about the heroines of classic Hollywood melodramas. This is Fresh Air. Betty Davis, Barbara Stanwyck, Marlena Dietrich, Greta Garbo. The movie heroines these actresses immortalized were iconoclastic women who set out to find love and fulfillment. Instead, what they usually discovered was disappointment. A new book called Contesting Tears discusses a group of women's films that explored the darker side of romance and marriage. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
They're called tearjerkers, weepies. Those magnificent women's movies of the 1930s and 40s that have left generations of audiences awash in a salty sea of melancholy. Though beloved by many, weepies are still somewhat condescended to by scholars, as though these films are too dumb to have intended the cinematic messages critics have discovered in them. Not so, says renowned Harvard philosopher and film theorist Stanley Cavell, who emerged from his study of four traditional women's films with a deepened respect for and even a fear of their power. In his new book, Contesting Tears, Cavell explores Gaslight, Letter from an Unknown Woman, Now Voyager, and Stella Dallas. He argues that these movies constitute a genre within women's films, which he calls the melodrama of the unknown woman. It's distinguished by an emphasis on its heroines' extreme isolation in their quest for joy and understanding, and a radically negative view of marriage. Thus, in Cavell's provocative reading of the famous 10 Kleenex closing scene of Stella Dallas, Barbara Stanwyck represents not a self-immolating icon of motherhood, but a spiritual soul sister to Ibsen's Nora, walking away from her former husband as well as the snooty, vacuous world he embodies. A warning here about Cavell's writing style. Contesting Tears is not always easy to read. That's partly because Cavell has a fondness for long sentences with misplaced clauses, and partly because he's smarter and better read than most people. He regularly digresses into meditations on Emerson, Wittgenstein, and the common origins in women's suffering of both Freudian psychoanalysis and Hollywood movies. Sometimes these asides are fascinating, sometimes baffling. But Contesting Tears is worth hacking through because of the ingeniousness of Cavell's close readings. In this book, he's continuing a discussion of women and marriage in film that he began in an earlier study of what he called Hollywood comedies of remarriage. In films like Adam's Rib and Bringing Up Baby, Cavell argued, movie couples split apart and then come together again when the hero fulfills the heroine's demand for equality, education, and transfiguration. In these melodramas of the unknown woman, the heroine also longs to be created anew through education by a man, as you can hear in this clip from Stella Dallas, where Stella is sharing her aspirations with Stephen, her husband-to-be.
Well, I've wanted to be different ever since I met you, and If I was around you long enough, I could be. Why, I could learn to talk like you and act like you. And pretty soon I... Well, you know, you've done a lot for me even in these couple of weeks.
But Stella and the other unknown woman heroines discover that marriage is, at best, disappointing, at worst, deadly. And so the heroines alternately seek their authentic selves by turning to other women or retreating into solitude or insanity. That's what happens to Ingrid Bergman at the end of Gaslight. Her final "I am woman, hear me roar" speech to evil husband Charles Boyer sounds great. That is, until Cavell points out, you realize that the price of her metamorphosis is madness.
If I were not mad, I could have helped you. Whatever you had done, I could have pitied and protected you. But because I am mad, I hate you. Because I am mad, I have betrayed you. And because I am mad, I'm rejoicing in my heart without a shred of pity, without a shred of regret, watching you go with glory in my heart. Mr. Cameron, come! Come, Mr. Cameron, take this man away! Take this man away!
One of Cavell's greatest achievements in contesting tears is that he offers a different spin on why these films are so sad. Certainly, Cavell acknowledges, their melancholy arises from the self-sacrifice of their heroines. But is it, Cavell asks, that the women are sacrificing themselves to the sad necessities of the world? Or that the women are claiming the right to judge a world as second rate that enforces this sacrifice? In other words, Stella Dallas and company learn that men, marriage, and society are bent on destroying rather than fostering their best selves. It's a realization bitter enough to make anybody cry.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Contesting Tears by Stanley Cavell. Music from Now Voyager. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross, and I want to remind you again about a concert we have coming up Thursday featuring clarinetist Don Byron and his band playing selections from his new CD, Bug Music, featuring music from the Duke Ellington Orchestra, the John Kirby Band, and the Raymond Scott Quintet. We'll close with a track from the CD. This is Duke Ellington's Dick D. Glide.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publishers of Love Invents Us, the first novel by Amy Bloom. This is NPR, National Public Radio.